For my message today, we're going to take a look at a topic that was suggested by our Bible journaling group. The last few sessions that we've had, we focused on topics that dealt with fire, and they wanted a break from all those fiery flames. So that means we're going to fight fire with water today, a whole lot of water. Specifically, we're going to go into the subject of Noah's Ark. Of course, if anybody here wants to check out Bible journaling, it's free to come on up. It's all ages. We'll have all the pencils there for you. Just bring some paper. We probably have some extra if you want to see what we're doing up there. Now, the story of Noah and the Ark, it's very timely for us to review now, and not just because of the similarities between Noah's time and our own. Now, we've started a new calendar year, which many people like to use as sort of a reset button. Of course, the story of the flood is exactly that. God was resetting conditions on the earth. But there's so much more that we can draw from Noah's life. There's numerous ways that you can look at the account and apply it in your own life. In fact, I'd enjoy hearing from you after services how you view this story. But for our purposes this afternoon, we're going to take a very specific view of the flood. That view is this: Noah's life is a lesson in godly obedience. Noah's life is a lesson in godly obedience. So before we get into the meat of what all that obedience was and how we can learn from it, we're just going to set the stage. Let's take a closer look at Noah and the world that he was coming into. Noah first appears in Genesis 5, which it contains a genealogy from Adam all the way through down to Noah. So if we want, let's open our Bibles to Genesis 5, and where we have this genealogy, and we have Noah introduced as a son of Lamech, and we learn about his name. And so we'll start in Genesis chapter 5 and verse 29. Genesis 5 and verse 29. And he called his name Noah, saying, "This one will comfort us concerning our work and the toil of our hands because of the ground which the Lord has cursed." Now, this introduction of Noah has a ton of foreshadowing in it. First, we have Lamech giving his son a name that means rest. Of course, Lamech was looking to a future state where the world would be given a rest. Now, how Lamech knew that change was coming, we don't know. But he knew that a rest was coming in the future. That's why he named Noah this way. And why was this rest so important? Well, it's because of the state that the world was in. Lamech alludes to it with the curse on the ground, and that's our second bit of foreshadowing. When we turn our pages over to Genesis 6, we see God echoing those very same words. And that's called out for us in verses 5 through 7. But before we get there, I want to take a closer look at Genesis chapter 6 and verse 3, because I know this was something that I had tripped over in the past. So just want to review it, make sure we're well settled with what this verse is intending. So Genesis chapter 6 and verse 3. "And the Lord said, 'My spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years.'" Now, if you're just casually reading through this verse, you might not grasp what's intended. If we go back to earlier in Genesis 5, we see that the patriarchs were tremendously long-lived. Most of them lived well over 800 years. But we have evidence in the Bible and from our own lives, of course, that after the flood, people were not nearly so long-lived. So we might read verse 3 and think that God's saying, okay, 120 years, that's how long men are going to live now. But if we go further into Genesis, we see that's not the case. Shem lived to at least at 600 years. Go many generations down from there, we come to Abraham, and even he lived to be 175, well past those 120 years. So then, what is this 120 years getting at? What this is, it's the duration of time that God is setting until his judgment's about to be delivered on the world. Even as bad as things were at that time, God's saying, we're still going to have a little more time for things to play out. And amid a world that was on this countdown, there was still a bright spot. Of all the people in the world, only Noah found grace in God's eyes. And we see that in verse 8. Though he was living in this wicked world, Noah obediently followed God's instruction. And we see this several places throughout the account. In fact, we see it right in the very beginning, at the start of Noah's story, in Genesis 6 and verse 9. Breaking into the verse, it says, Noah was a just man, perfect in his generations. Noah walked with God. Now, it doesn't say that Noah walked near God or that he merely followed after God and the path that was set before him. Noah is described as walking with God. This paints a picture, at least in my mind, of someone who's walking side by side with another. They're working together in harmony towards the same goal. And it also gives the idea of an ongoing, steady relationship, one that grows over time. This is a very special distinction that only one other person in the Bible is given, and that's Enoch. You see that in Genesis 5 and verse 22. Now, you could argue that others did indeed walk with God. I mean, we are told to walk in God's ways, but in terms of having this exact phrase applied, Noah is in a very special category. We're not told how God instructed Noah, but he must have learned God's ways. Not only that, he kept those ways in a darkening world. And this is the reason that Noah found grace in God's eyes, so much so that he was chosen for a very specific task. Let's see that now, what that task was in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 14. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood, make rooms in the ark, and cover it inside and outside with pitch. And this is how you shall make it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, its width 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. Now it's amazing how much instruction can be packed even in this single verse. God is giving crucial instructions with this ratio. This ratio of 1 to 6 of the width to the length gives it extraordinary stability. It's important for what the ark was about to go through, because it wasn't built with any sort of steering. It didn't have sails. It needed to be stable for what it was about to happen. As we go on, there's further instructions in verse 16 for how the windows should be made, where the doors should be. And then verse 17, God tells Noah why this is important. Behold, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. And then he gives further instruction of the birds, of the creeping things that should be brought in, and gives instruction for storing up food that they're going to need. And then in verse 22, we have this recorded. Thus Noah did according to all that God commanded him. So he did. So there, verse 22, concrete proof that Noah was obedient to God. It's recorded plainly for us in the scripture. He didn't just do some of what God commanded or do his best as to what God's instructions were. He did all that God commanded him to do. This is a theme that we see continuing on into the next chapter. In Genesis 7 and verse 1, then the Lord said to Noah, come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. You shall take with you seven each of every clean animal, a male and his female, two each of the animals that are unclean, a male and his female. Also seven each of the birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of the earth. Now here we see an expansion in the instruction of the animals that were being brought onto the ark. In Genesis 6:20, it was just two of every animal coming on. But here, it's expanded to seven, or in some translations it says seven pairs of the clean animals were to be brought on. Now it's curious. Noah didn't have to be told, well, which animals are clean and which are unclean. He already knew what that was, well in advance of the Mount Sinai covenant. But still, why was God calling this out separately? While the unclean animals simply could reproduce after the flood, For the clean animals, additional pairs of them were necessary. One reason could be for sacrifices to offer to God of those clean animals. Again, something that Noah already knew about, and we're going to see that a little bit later. Another reason could be to ensure genetic diversity as those animals went out after the flood. So let's continue on. Genesis 7:4. For after 7 more days I will cause it to rain on the earth, 40 days and 40 nights, and I will destroy from the face of the earth all living things that I have made. And Noah did according to all that the Lord commanded him. Again, Noah's doing everything that he was told. This obedience to God's instruction didn't stop once they were on the ark. You might think, okay, I've got all the hard work done, the ark's been built, we're on board, the door's shut, we can take it easy. But that wasn't the case. I mean, Noah and his family were in the midst of a world-changing calamity. And of course, they still had all those animals on board that they needed to care for. And for as long as they were on the ark, Noah remained obedient to God and his way. And we need to think about that a little bit, because how long was that trip on the ark? It certainly wasn't just a 3-hour tour that they set out upon. And as long as I've been familiar with the story of the Noah and the ark, I've had it wrong. In fact, when I was talking with my girls about it this morning, the answer that I always had stuck in my head was one I got from one of the girls. Because that idea of it raining for 40 days and 40 nights, that's the part that sticks in our minds. And for however long it was, that's what I had in my head. The flood was just for 40 days. But that's not the case. It went on much longer than that. So let's do some quick math. In Genesis 7 and verse 11, we're given a reference point. In the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the 17th day of the month, on that day all the fountains of the great deep were broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. And then the rain was on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights. So, of course, that's what sticks in our minds, right? That's a number. 40 happens a lot in the Bible, so we grab onto that. And we see it again in verse 17, so we might be thinking it's 40 days. Now the flood was on the earth 40 days, and the waters increased and lifted up the ark, and it rose high above the earth. And if you stop there, or you just kind of skim over the reading and just get to the part at the end where the rainbow shows up, you might think, okay, it's just 40 days. But let's read on and see what the truth of the matter is. We can drop down to verse 24, and we'll see plainly that the flood was for more than 40 days. Genesis 7 and verse 24. And the water prevailed on the earth 150 days. But here, we're still just in the early stages. The flood was still not done. It was at this point, 150 days in, that God remembered Noah and his passengers. We see this in Genesis chapter 8 and verse 1. Then God remembered Noah and every living thing, and all the animals that were with him in the ark. And God made a wind to pass over the earth, and the water subsided. The fountains of the deep and the windows of heaven were also stopped, and the rain from heaven was restrained. And the waters receded continually from the earth. At the end of the 150 days, the waters decreased. Then the ark rested on the 7th month, the 17th day of the month, on the mountains of Ararat. So recall that Noah entered the ark in the 2nd month in the 17th day. So that means it was 5 months from the point that the rain started till the ark finally settled down on the mountaintop. But of course, that still was not the end of the flood. Let's continue on. In verse 5, and the waters decreased continually until the 10th month. In the 10th month, on the first day of the month, the tops of the mountains were seen. But still, we're only at the 7.5-month mark. And the flood still is not done. In verse 6, so it came to pass at the end of 40 days that Noah opened the window of the ark which he had made. And he sent out a raven which kept going to and fro until the waters had dried up. He also sent out from himself a dove to see if the waters had receded from the ground. Of course, the dove returns. Noah waits a week, sends it out again. This time it comes back with an olive leaf. But still, Noah remained patient. He was waiting for God to tell him what to do. So another 7 days go by, Noah releases that dove. This time it does not return. So let's pick up the account now, dropping down to verse 13 of Genesis 8. And it came to pass in the 601st year, in the first month, on the first day of the month, that the waters were dried up from the earth. And Noah removed the covering of the ark and looked, and indeed the surface of the ground was dry. So we had a flood that started in year 600 of Noah's life, the second month, 17th day. Now we're at the 601st year, first day, first month. Still, Noah obediently waited. Verse 14, and in the second month, on the 27th day of the month, the earth was dried. So we've skipped forward another month and 26 days, but Noah still waited on the ark. Then we see in verse 15, then God spoke to Noah, saying, go out of the ark, you and your wife, and your sons' wives with you. Bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and cattle and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth, so that they may abound on the earth and be fruitful and multiply on the earth. So Noah went out, and his sons and his wife and his sons' wives with him. So you might ask, how exactly is this passage showing Noah's obedience to God? It's because Noah remained on the ark even after he saw the dry land. I mean, the rains had stopped, the water subsided, the ark settles on the mountain. The waters continue to recede, and eventually that dove does not return. But Noah, he was looking out. He could not help but to see the changed world around them. And even though his eyes showed him that the land was dry, he waited for God. He waited until God said it was time to leave the ark. Then and only then did he and his family and the animals disembark. Then in verse 20, we have yet another record of Noah's obedience. Genesis 8 and verse 20. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. So here we have several things wound up into this single verse. As it was when the animals were loaded into the ark, Noah still maintained the distinction between clean and unclean. Noah did not have to ask God, hey, which ones are okay for me to use for this sacrifice? It was just part of what he did. He knew what the right thing was to do. We also see that Noah was obedient in the fact that he was offering this burnt offering. And again, this is well before the instruction that Moses had been given about offerings. Noah knew that he needed to give an offering to God for the salvation that God had given to Noah and his family. So Noah built an altar, and he did exactly that. And going on into chapter 9, again, we see Noah's continued obedience. In Genesis 9, verse 1 and verse 7, Noah is told to be fruitful and multiply, just as Adam and Eve have been told to do. And he's told to bring forth abundantly from the earth. Now, while the specific obedience to these two points isn't recorded for us in the Bible, we see evidence of it today. And as a result of this obedience, God creates a special covenant, one that was not just for Noah, but for all life on the earth. We see this in Genesis chapter 9 and verse 8. Then God spoke to Noah and his son and to his sons, saying, As for me, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds, the cattle, and every beast of the earth with you, of all that go out of the ark, every beast of the earth. Thus I establish my covenant with you. Never again shall all flesh be cut off by the waters of the flood. Never again shall there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you for perpetual generations. I set my rainbow in the cloud, and it shall be for the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. Now, after coming through the events of the flood, this must have been a tremendous relief. God promised that never again would such an event happen. And as a sign of that, we're given one of the most spectacular sights, the rainbow, something that people of all ages stop when they see one in the sky. It's also a curious contrast. After the destruction of the wicked world, we have a beautiful sight set up in the sky. just as Noah's obedience towards God was a contrast to all those around him. This obedience was so powerful, it gets used in other parts of the Bible. In Hebrews 11 and verse 7, Noah's held up as a powerful example of faith by all that he did. Then we have Peter referencing Noah's example in two different of his letters. So let's take a look at that first reference, and we'll go over to 1 Peter chapter 3. And we're going to read verses 18 to 22. So 1 Peter chapter 3, starting in verse 18. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God, being put to death in the flesh, but made alive by the Spirit, by whom also he went and preached to the spirits in prison, who formerly were disobedient when once the divine longsuffering waited in the days of Noah, while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is, eight souls, were saved through water. Of course, this is calling back to that 120-year span before God delivered his judgment. And even though there was that extra time allowed, only eight were saved, obedient Noah and his family. Verse 21, there is also an antitype which now saves us, baptism. Not the removal of the filth of the flesh, but the answer of a good conscience toward God through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, who has gone into heaven and is at the right hand of God, angels and authorities and powers having been made subject to him. So again, here in these verses, there's a lot to unpack. Just look at the parallels that are being outlined for us. We understand that baptism isn't just for washing away the physical dirt and grime that's on us. It's an outward expression of our commitment towards God and being obedient to his commands. As Peter says here, it's our good conscience with God that is cleansing us. The same is being implied of Noah. It wasn't the torrential rains that washed Noah and made him right with God. It was his faithful obedience that allowed him to have that good conscience and to be saved. I see that godly obedience as a bright thread that runs throughout all the story of Noah. His story is indeed a warning to society. Make no mistake of that. But it's also an encouraging example for us. Because though Noah is listed as walking with God, he was still just a man. He lived in a troubled society, just as we do, and no doubt had problems of his own, again, just as we do. Even so, Noah kept obediently walking with God, even in the midst of a crumbling world. Now, we might not be building a massive ark, just as Noah did, but God's promises, those are our ark. They are our lifeboat in this age. And that's what we need to remember from Noah's story. No matter where the waves may toss us around, no matter how long the waves may toss us around, we need to walk steadfastly with God. God promises to carry us through the stormy weather. And then when those waters settle, our feet will be planted back on solid ground, on the solid ground of God's promises.